Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm back for another week of radio in Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick. And today I'm joined by Alan Sitzma, senior editor of New York Magazine's Daily Food and Beverage News, GrubStreet.com. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, let's just get right into it. Let's discuss what's going on in the food news world in New York City.
What is going on in the food news world in the city and beyond? Well, I guess the one thing that we are seeing is that restaurants are finally starting to open in New York. It's been kind of a slow going this year, and I think a lot of people have been anticipating new restaurants. At least I have, because we need stuff to write about on Grub Street. So it's nice when places actually open and give you something to talk about.
There's been some really amazing and crazy news on Grub Street this week, and you guys always aggregate the best stories. There was a live frog in a salad bag.
Which seems to happen a lot. We were talking about that story, and not that we have these long, involved meetings about lettuce frogs. This was over IM, but our New York editor, Hugh, and I were discussing this and very quickly looked back. And it's about every 6 months that a live frog shows up in a bag of lettuce.
Do you think it's only specifically geographic, like Florida, they have a lot of frogs? Or is that just frogs love salad?
I wish I knew enough about the way Walmart harvests its lettuce to identify the source of the frogs. But it is nice. I think they do it as like PR stunts. They, you know, just to remind everyone every once in a while that like, no, this is real. This is real food. We grow it in the ground, and sometimes there are animals in it.
And maybe you should wash your salad.
Well, yeah, it would be weird to find it after the... it would be alarming.
Yeah. I mean, the article, I was wondering what happened to the frog after the article, because they did not discuss that.
That's a good question. I would imagine that the frog just hopped off, probably. The person probably didn't trap it.
And smoked a cigarette and was like, thank God.
You can eat...
Edible.
Yeah, I know. Frog legs are a thing.
You heard it here first. Walmart frog legs.
Added value.
And what else? So, the Food Network may be acquired by Disney.
This is true. Well, maybe.
Possibly.
You have to wonder who's putting a story like that out. But it seems as though scripts... This is actually sort of boring, just corporate stuff. I don't think Food Network is going to change in any way, shape, or form. But... Yeah, Scripps, the parent company, is apparently, some family trust that owns it has dissolved, and so now there are all these buyers, and it would make sense for a corporate entity like Disney to buy it.
I think the most important part of that article that I noticed was that there's a frozen Kirin beer machine at Epcot Center at Disney, which is really impressive.
The most important part of that story was that we ran our photo of Paula Deen riding a pile of money, which is easily my favorite photo ever, and we will run that any chance we get. The frozen Kirin beer, I'm not really sure how that works out. I think it's sort of like the Coors Light mentality of it's ice cold, and but the colder it is, the less you taste.
I wonder, it sounds like Bourbon Street, because I wonder if you can actually carry that around Disneyland or Disney World.
I guess it is all internal. I don't know. I mean, the other big news is that at the Magic Kingdom, they're going to have some like fine dining restaurant where you can finally get booze. But there's always been the German beer garden at Epcot, and Epcot's better. So I don't understand why you would go to like Bell's Ball or whatever they're calling it to have like you know, bad red wine, inevitably, that they're going to sell, when you can just go to the German Beer Garden at Epcot Center and then see, like, the moving fountains that dance around Spaceship Earth, too.
And then just throw it up on It's a Small World After All afterwards?
Maybe, well, then you got to go back. I don't know. It's tricky.
It's very tricky. My
knowledge of Disney World is circa... the last time I was there, I was, like, 7. So it's circa 1989.
Yeah. No, me too. That would be an interesting food map.
Right. In my mind, Captain EO still plays there, but I don't think that's probably true.
So, you know, before Grub Street, you worked at Gourmet as well as the Food Network.
I did.
You know, before that, let's rewind the tape completely. And I want to know how you got into the food world in the first place.
Blind luck. No, it's not super exciting. It's one of those... I grew up in one of those families where food was sort of a big part. It's not like I grew up in this big Italian family. I'm an only child and we're from the Midwest. But, you know, dinner was the time that we all got together. Dinner was at the same time every night. My mom made a point to, like, shop and cook. And so, like, having real food around was always just something that, you know, I knew. And we went to restaurants a lot. You know, I liked restaurants. I moved to New York. I liked going to restaurants. And I think kind of as like a half joke, my parents were like, oh, well, you know, you should go to culinary school. So I did actually go to culinary school. And it was great. I loved it. And then I staged in a couple of restaurants for about an hour. It might have been a little bit more than an hour, but it was not very long. And it was long enough to know that I hated it. You know, 13 hours a day, 6 days a week, getting yelled at in French because your carrots are, you know, brunoise instead of Macedoine. And the whole thing was a little intense. So it just wasn't for me. I wasn't a big adrenaline junkie like that. And I had gone to college for communications. So I said, oh, you know, I could write for a food magazine. And this was where I did get really lucky, was that about a day after I had that thought, Saveur was looking for new interns. I heard about it. I got the internship. And then when that ended, after about 3 months, I got really lucky again. That, like, the day my internship at Saveur ended, Gourmet was looking for a new assistant editor who had some cooking experience and some writing experience. So I just was very fortunate to fall into a place where Ruth Reichel worked and got to kind of just glean things from her and steal ideas as much as possible.
What was the moment when you were a kid when you started to think about, wow, food could potentially be a career for me in whatever capacity?
I don't know. You know, I mean, it must have been after college. It was always just something that I kind of thought about as a recreational activity, not as any kind of professional activity. I never thought necessarily that restaurants were something I was going to go into. And then I just sort of, you know, like I said, I do like restaurants. Maybe I will learn how to, you know, I didn't really know how to cook. I knew a little bit, but then, you know, just kind of went with that. And it was just I kind of feeling it out as I went a little bit.
What kind of stuff were you eating growing up? Like, what's your mom make that you miss?
Like American comfort food, you name it. It was, you know, not to knock my mom's skills. She's a good cook, but it's not like I was eating these amazing sort of traditional dishes. You know, meatloaf, spaghetti and meatballs. She used to make this thing. this is going to ruin my credibility. She used to make this thing that was like pork chops that were basically cooked in... They were like baked in cream of mushroom soup. You pour the soup over. It was like definitely from the back of a can, the recipe. And it was like delicious. But I probably haven't had that since I went to Epcot Center. So I imagine my nostalgia is probably getting the best of me with that one. But, you know, I mean, we have, I think, still at my house, you know, Bon Appetit's going back to like 1977 or something. So there's definitely been a long kind of like food's just always kind of been around and something to think about.
If you're willing to reveal it, do you have a food vice that you can't stay away from? Like for me, it's probably Korean fried chicken or...
That is the fanciest food vice in the
world. Oh, fried chicken in general. Okay. So, you know, but preferably in a Snuggie.
Even still, that's not a particularly embarrassing vice.
Good point. Okay. I don't know. Peanut butter from the jar. I don't know.
Oh, mine is definitely American cheese. I put it in way more stuff than I probably
do. You think
should.
It's cheese?
No, it does. They can't even call it cheese. It's cheese product.
Yeah.
Part of it is cheese. But it's like, it's amazing. It's an amazing ingredient because you can put it in things and it melts and it keeps them smooth and emulsified. Whatever chemicals are in there kind of like, you know, employ their power onto. Like, I can see why people put it in grits because it makes grits, you know, they never really seize up. It is sort of magic. It doesn't taste like anything, but also fine,
I
guess.
It's like probably 10% cheese and
I would be surprised if it were that much. I think it's like maybe 4% leftover cheddar, as much vegetable oil as they can emulsify in, and then just a ton of chemicals.
You are constantly reporting on the food world. Do you tend to eat out often, or do you find yourself cooking at home a lot, or a little bit of both?
Definitely both. My girlfriend is a very good cook also. So we tend to fight over who's going to make dinner. And we're really bad at sharing the kitchen. So it's definitely one person or the other person. It's rarely like a joint, endeavor, but yeah, I mean, you know, my job, I'm very lucky that part of my job is going out. So I definitely do. And then in my free time, I just like to go out. So it is a lot of going out. But what I find is that, you know, when it's just my own kind of time, I tend to like fall back into the same restaurants that I really like, as opposed to kind of, you know, whatever the new hot place is. Because then it feels a little less like work, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what are some of your watering holes, if you will?
Just like places that I go to all the time.
Yeah. Your go-tos.
It's all about proximity to where I live. Franny's is definitely like the kind of go-to for me. Roman's in Fort Greene. I also really like Vinegar Hill House. But then we end up going back to like Keene's a lot, weirdly, which is not anywhere near where I live, but is still, great. And my girlfriend used to live on the Upper East Side, so we would go to Melon's all the time and do like martinis and burgers at night. It was like the perfect, like, Tuesday night, don't really want to like do that much. And then she moved to Brooklyn, which was great for every reason except the fact that now there's no reason to go to Melon's anymore because it's nowhere near either one of us, and it's not quite good enough to, you know, spend 3 hours on the subway going to and from. But those are sorts of, you know, just really simple, straightforward. The thing everyone says, the very boring thing everyone says, simple, straightforward, blah, 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 blah.
Well, all right. If you're, for all the ladies out there, if you're going to cook your lady a special meal, what's like the surefire dish that you're going to make and she's going to be impressed? Is it the pork with mushroom soup on top?
Yeah, it's definitely that. It's definitely crack open a can of Campbell's. No, what do we make at home? I mean, that's the thing, like cooking isn't one of those special things. It's the thing that we kind of want to do as much as we can. This is a terrible answer. There isn't like, oh, special dinner I'm going to cook for you, because we do cook so often that, you know, I think when we really do it, it's just spending more on ingredients and probably kind of going over the top with like buy, you know, a really nice steak or something and then do that.
Some gold leaf foil on top.
Yeah, a lot of gold leaf. Caviar. Caviar is actually something that is a special dish that we do. There's this like, I do this pasta with like lemon zest and chives and then like a canal of caviar on top. And that's actually the thing that we do when there is like some special dinner. But usually it's because a guest is coming over and we want to like kind of pretend that that's how we cook all the time. Oh, this, we just throw this together. This is how we eat. We know that that's not really the case.
Every other day, it's French onion soup and some grilled cheese. No.
Yeah, French onion. Yeah, just every other day. Yeah, that's what we do. Sweetbreads meuniere. yeah, just all sorts of things like that.
So we're going to take a really quick break, but when we get back, we're going to get really into a lot of what's happening within the food world in New York and beyond. And stay tuned. You are listening to You Look Hungry. We'll be right back.
Disappointed, I get angry when you move. Banjo, your computer is so slow, I can't even use this thing.
Yeah, I should probably get a new one. Do you have any suggestions?
Oh, totally, man. You should go to TechServe.
Okay, what's so good about TechServe?
Well, they've got this awesome new insider program that's free when you get a new Mac with AppleCare. So you should buy your computer there because you get 50% off data transfer, free loaner computers, front-of-the-line repair privileges, an annual Mac tune-up service, backup consultation and setup, seminars, and much more.
Okay, yeah, where's TechServe?
It's at 119 West 23rd Street in New York City. They're New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and service provider, and you should totally check out TechServe.com for more information.
All right, that settles it. I'm headed to TechServe.
Chelsea.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I am still your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm joined today by Alan Sitzma of Grub Street. And before the break, we were discussing his background and a little bit about the New York food world, and I want to get into food trends. You know, I always think of cupcakes as like New Yorkers love cupcakes because it's like an emotional eating hug.
Everyone loves cupcakes.
Yeah.
Everyone loves cupcakes.
They're never going to go out of style, but there's other things that kind of rise and fall. And, you know, times can be tough in the streets and sometimes we eat our emotions. So I want to know what some of the things you're seeing in trends, whether it's tacos or bugs, whatever, that you kind of feel like are indicative of maybe what's happening in America at the moment.
Are bugs something you've been seeing?
No, I feel like I read one article. I really want to pretend that there's a bug trend. There's
I think
not.
At NOMA, they do that ant.
The live ants. Yeah.
I think that is the moment that you knew he's just joking with everyone. Like that he's like, wow, I can't believe I convinced all you people to fly to Copenhagen, spend $400 for leaves that I found on the street. Which is not, actually, I've eaten there and that's not fair to say because I loved it as much as everyone else. But food trends, I think the big thing we're seeing is... you know, but now two restaurants have opened in the last week that negate this. But the big thing was, you know, this is the year of like no reservations, not the show, but just restaurants that don't take reservations. I think that that sort of aesthetic that, you know, Chang started with Momofuku that really stripped down has been pushed as far as it can go, kind of really to the limit. And now you're seeing that people are, you know, there's a vocabulary among kind of diners who are willing to eat in those sort, you know, they know that great food can come from a place that is sort of dingy and divier than what they might be used to. And as a result, you're definitely seeing, you know, 2-3 hour waits. But now even that, I think, is as far as it's going to go. And, you know, I think people who really follow the scene and are really wanting to be at the new place, even their kind of, you know, Mission Chinese was great and all, but they're ready to kind of make reservations again. But you know, I think that also speaks to this different dynamic where people keep saying food is the new rock. Maybe they said that a couple of years ago, but there is something to that where I think that this is sort of the first time where the really that kind of indie mentality, that sort of DIY sensibility in restaurants is a more compelling to a much greater number of people than the kind of like the corporate washed sort of like big money project, because we're seeing those fall left and right, and in their place new big places like that aren't really opening and they aren't doing well. But it's like new, you know, you look at like Battersby and, you know, Mission Chinese, of course, and those are the sorts of places that, you know, not just young people are going to, but they'd be going there anyway, but that, you know, kind of older customers are sort of gravitating towards as well.
So yeah, I mean, you know, what types of restaurants beyond the no reservations policy, which, by the way, what do you think that's about?
I mean, it's just so much easier for the restaurant. I don't think there's any secret. Like, if you can just deal with not having a reservationist and you can have enough people to fill your dining room every night, then it's like one less headache to worry about. Yeah. So I think it just makes sense for a restaurant. And if you have a bar, then you're monetizing that wait too. I mean, that's, you know, people are just drinking while they're waiting to have dinner. So you're getting that extra hour of like, you know, 2 or 3 drinks. Well, maybe, I don't know. Is that a lot or a little?
5 drinks.
I can do like 2 or 3 drinks while I wait for an hour, but maybe I drink a lot more than everyone.
No, I'm with you. You know, Southern food, that's been a really big thing, comfort food. And I'm noticing a lot of barbecue as well.
Yeah, I'm seeing those two things. I think that those sort of peaked a little bit, and it's pushing into kind of more exotic territory while still hitting a lot of those same flavors. Asian food is everywhere right now, and it definitely, you know, street food style is something that we're seeing a lot of. And I think that, especially with, you know, you talk about barbecue, and I think it hits a lot of the same sorts of comfort zones, the same kind of, like, you know, just super fatty, really kind of like flavor bombs. But you're getting all this sort of like spice and, you know, kind of like, you know, you go to Pock Pock and it's, you know, one farmer in Florida who can grow these like crazy Thai herbs that Ricker uses. And it's like you're seeing that kind of like it's a more interesting way to have something kind of slow cooked, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. You guys have a really great list of sort of the top restaurants in New York right now, of most popular. Off of that list, what are some of the spots that you love? Or
you mean the power rankings?
The power rankings. I mean, I don't know if you can discuss that, but
I mean, it's a pretty complex machine that we feed a lot of statistics into, and then it spits out, it generates the list and the quippy blurbs for us. So that's really helpful. No, I mean, you know, that story, the restaurant power rankings, if, you know, SEO wasn't ever apparent, it's a reactive thing, not necessarily a proactive thing. I mean, what we're doing is we're charting, you know, buzz and kind of word of mouth and what we're hearing back and, you know, kind of aggregating all of that. So it's not really the places that I love necessarily. I mean, I do like a lot of places on the list week to week, but it's more about kind of where other people are going and, you know, where it's popular. And so it's interesting because you see, you know, popularity comes in a lot of forms, and especially in New York. So you see places where, you know, one reviewer after another has said, like, well, maybe the food's not so great, but it's still, you know, night in and night out packed full of people. And so, you know, how's that happening? Where are these people coming from? What's generating that buzz beyond the fact that the food is really good?
It's fall. Restaurant openings are happening. What restaurants are you psyched about opening, the openings for, or have been to, or look forward to seeing open?
Yeah, well, they're finally happening. It's a much slower sort of start this year. I think, you know, the last couple of years, it's been kind of August, Labor Day, you start to see the machine, the fall opening machine really kick into gear. And this year, it's a much slower burn. A lot of people are kind of waiting until November, December. But the places that I'm most looking forward to, I don't, you know, I'm looking forward to the Beatrice, in not because I necessarily want to eat there, but because it's going to be a lot of fun to cover. So that's number one. What else? Michael White has a couple of new projects. I know. I think it'll be interesting to see because Nicoletta, his pizza place, was the first like real kind of bomb that he had. I mean, people still go and it's pizza and it, you know, it's not going to close, but it was not a place that was sort of rapturously loved the way his other restaurants have been. And so these new places sound like they're a little more ambitious. Ristorante Marini is going to be another high-end place on the Upper East Side, which is a really interesting move because I think even though he has a place on 59th, I think he has sort of more of a... He's really good at kind of bringing that downtown mentality to fine dining. So that'll be interesting to see. And then he has this other place, The Butterfly, that's opening, which sounds really kind of crazy because the food is... He's from Wisconsin, and so the food is like a, you know, kind of like a Midwestern supper club. So there's, I think they're doing like chopped steak or Salisbury steak or something, you know, chefed up. But the thing that I'm really interested in is that Eben Freeman is going to be doing drinks. And, you know, from what I've seen and the kind of samples that I've seen, he's going back to some of the like really kind of awesome out there ideas that he was doing at Taylor before Taylor closed. I think there's one, it was like, it's like slate cured, like slate infused vodka, slate cured vodka. I don't know what they were calling it, but, it sounds like the drinks are going to be really crazy.
I feel like I had a mojito there that was a jelly.
At Taylor. Yeah, they were doing absinthe gummy bears. I miss that place so much. Not because it was good, I don't want to make the mistake of endorsing it as like a great restaurant, because but it was fun, and there was, that's the thing that I also think is missing, like that Taylor was one of the last restaurants where it was really not necessarily about, you know, what customers were going to love. It was about what they wanted to do. It was about what Sam wanted to do and what Evan wanted to do with the bar program. And it was just like so nuts. And so, you know, people didn't really respond to that one, which is too bad. But, you know, the baseline of dining in New York has come way up. Like every place has great, not every place, but, you know, there are so many more great places to eat probably than there have been in the past that you can just sort of stroll into. But at the very, very top, it seems like there isn't quite as much ambition, or maybe ambition's the wrong word, but a willingness to experiment.
Yeah, what do you think the demand of New Yorkers and the New Yorker palate is at the moment that dictates the style of restaurant that's out there today versus before?
Right. I mean, definitely food quality plays a part, but not necessarily food, you know, like... One of the things that we have to do, just every once in a while, you have to like dig back into the New York Times archive and read a review from like 1996, and the kinds of restaurants that they're talking about and the kinds of like food pairings that they're talking about are just so out of whack with the way people are eating now. Yeah, it's a lot of, you know, foie gras with like, oh, I'm trying to think of one. I mean, you know, there's great stuff like chicken with like strawberry sauce all over it. And it's really weird. And I think, I mean, part of it is that I think people have become a lot more kind of aware of what constitutes a restaurant, so they're not willing to put up with, you know, crap. Like, a chef can't come out and say, well, no, this is fine dining, because I think people are maybe a little bit more aware of what really is good food versus what is just something some chef is saying is good food because it's kind of wacky. So that's what makes a place like a Terra even more impressive, is that they can come in and do just kind of really not out there, but, you know, really unique novel stuff that is hyper manipulated. And, you know, people respond to it positively because they're starting with this really strong foundation, I think.
If you could pretend that you were Miss Cleo and forecast 2013, whether, you know, Barack Obama or Mitt Romney wins,
right?
What do you think New Yorkers would eat in both scenarios? What would be their sort of food trend for each candidate?
You know, I don't know that, you know, it's New York. We're kind of insulated from the rest of America in this weird way. I mean, this is it's a pretty grandiose thing for a food blogger to say. I think in 2013 people are going to be eating at Wiley's new restaurant. People are going to be eating. I don't think it changes that dramatically.
It's, I just threw you the worst, hardest question ever.
It's a weird. I hadn't really thought about that. People are going to be eating burgers and cupcakes no matter what.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
They're going to be eating, you know, Austria places, and yeah, you know, they're gonna open. Oh, I think I do think that like kind of old schooly classic French is due for a comeback a little bit. I think that you're starting to see, like with Calliope, people were kind of interested in that bistro aesthetic, and Balthazar is expanding because it's been around long enough that now it's this sort of legacy place. And you know, Carmelini's going to open the new, what's he calling it?
Lafayette. Yeah.
He's going to open that, and that's going to just, like, explode. So I think once that starts happening, you're going to see people kind of, I think there's going to be a renewed interest for the bistro aesthetic a little bit, and I think people are going to be a little, like, French onion soup, maybe, hopefully.
It's all about the French onion soup and the American cheese sandwich. And lastly, is there any particular food you hope becomes very popular?
I have been pushing for goat for so long, and I think El Toro Blanco, the Mexican restaurant that opened in Greenwich Village yesterday, has like whole roasted goat and goat tacos, and I think that's a pretty mainstream place. That is not a place that's necessarily trying to appeal to the biggest, most out there food lovers. So I think maybe it's the beginning of goat being a real serious, like actual new protein that is kind of, you know, it'll never be as knee-jerk as like chicken, pork, beef, but I think maybe it can be like a rabbit alternative.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, thank you so much to Joe Galarraga, Jack Inslee, and the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio Network. I'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.